Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 194 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we have Craig Etheridge, Hot Laps Craig. Been meaning to get him on. I feel like I'm saying this a lot lately. Maybe it's just a sign of the times, being able to catch up with people I haven't talked to in a while, but it's true with Craig. Been meaning to get him on the show forever and finally had the opportunity. He was nice enough to drive down from Baltimore. We hung out on my porch. It turns out, and I'll explain it in the beginning here, that it was right when my neighbor decided to start construction on his front porch. So we had a little jackhammer background ambience for you to enjoy. I think it's pretty low in there, but if you're hearing something in the mix, that's what's going on. Anyway, it was great to talk to Craig, and we're going to get right to that conversation after I talk to you about a new exciting sponsor of the Wide Angle Podium Network, and it's Wattbike. Wattbike. It's a smart trainer. It's like the top of the line. Here's the deal. You have your cyclocross bike. You race, ride that for cyclocross. You got your gravel bike, ride that for gravel. You got your road bike. You got your mountain bike. You got all these different types of bikes. Then why are you taking one of those bikes and repurposing it for a different use inside your house? You're taking an outdoor bike and trying to make it an indoor bike, where Wattbike is an indoor bike that rides like it's an outdoor bike. The Wattbike features real ride feel technology. It's the closest feeling to riding on the road thanks to the Wattbike's Adam's unique use of chains and sprockets. The Wattbike also gives you precise and reliable data. Wattbike creates the most accurate and reliable indoor bikes in the world, ensuring plus minus 2% accuracy across the full power curve. It's so accurate that it is used as the global talent ID and training tool of the UCI World Cycling Center. The latest model is the Wattbike Atom, which is the smart version, and it is now available for the first time in the United States. The Atom works in all your favorite apps. It is also Zwift certified, so you know your output is going to be exactly what it says on the screen, which is perfect for competing in online racing. You can find out more about the Wattbike at wattbike.com/US. That's wattbike.com/US. And even better than that, if you check down in the show notes, there is a link that'll get you right there, and that'll also let Wattbike know that you heard about it here on Cyclocross Radio. Speaking of the Wide Angle Podium Network, also go check out everything we're doing there. Please go over to the YouTube page, check out all of Little Guy's race previews, and hit the subscribe button over there. Rate and review this show on iTunes. Tell your friends. We're going back to a weekly, and I really want to get all of those listeners that may have strayed away back into the fold. So tell your friends. Get them back over to Cyclocross Radio. All right. We got Hot Laps Craig. We're talking to him on my porch, and we're doing that right now.
Craig, thanks for coming to D.C.
Thank you. Yeah, not too far of a drive, but I'm excited to come down here and see you.
Yeah, it's funny because we were just chatting before I started recording. You've been out here for 5 years now.
Yep, just about six.
Yeah, almost 6 years. And I love it when somebody can actually come by, and we're sitting out on my porch here, properly socially distanced.
On a nice hot July day. This might be one of the hotter ones.
Too. Yeah, 790, I know. I should actually
293.
Oops,
it's hot. Nice hot day out here, but it is great to spend some time outside, at least together for a little while.
And as I was telling you before we started, my neighborhood has pretty much just been this peaceful, quiet oasis. And then we planned on this. And then just this morning, a roll-off got dropped off at my neighbor's house, and then the jackhammers started, and now they are tearing up the front porch. So if you hear any of that, that's what's going on.
Or if you squeeze your ears enough, it might sound like a woodpecker.
Yes, exactly. hopefully we won't get too much bleed over, but it'll give it that real-world environment.
Exactly.
Craig, I've I mean, we've known each other for quite some time at this point, but you're somebody I can't believe that I haven't talked to on this podcast until now. So I'm very happy to do it.
Thanks for making the time.
Yeah.
Asking,
and
yeah.
You've almost, you know, we look at cyclocross and everybody, you know, we can look at cyclocross from the European, from the pro. This is a job. This is a career. This is very, you know, buttoned down in the way things are. And then I think in the U.S., we kind of, at least starting 15, 20 years ago, it was kind of very grassroots. It was,
yeah,
let's just go out there and make something happen and just do it because it's fun and it's something that we want to do. And I look at somebody like you and you kind of embody that, but then you took it to a level where, you know, you were at the top of the domestic scene, which is kind of cool. I like that vibe to it.
Yeah, thanks. It was definitely... You know, obviously there's like the ebbs and flows of the community and the environment and the racing as a whole, but it was certainly an opportunity and the product of that ebb and flow of like when I got in it and how it was supported and the chances I was given to take it to where I could and how interested I was in it at the time too.
Yeah. And riding your bike as a job, bike messenger for years. How did it start? Where did bikes come into the life?
My parents would say it probably started with me in the backwoods of our Wisconsin farm on an old beat up mountain bike, just trying to figure out what mountain biking was. And then it really developed more like the racing and like my love for like just getting out and riding and exploring was in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where I went to college. Had a couple of good friends and I had an old steel Trek 930 single track XC that I just bombed around on and loved it and started doing some mountain bike racing. And that was really like where I started to fall in love with just the idea of getting out and pushing myself on the bike. And it was mountain bike racing in lacrosse.
And did you find success pretty early? I mean, did you go into it and go, oh, hey, this is actually something that I'm pretty good at?
You know, I think it was funny because I wasn't terrible at it, but I wasn't like super productive with like how much I race. I was into it, but I didn't really do a lot. I just did, you know, a few races a year. I wasn't bad. But I think at the time, you know, the Wars series, which is continues to be a really popular series, had four levels. I was a sport level racer still. I never quite got up to even comp or expert at the time, but I just had a lot of fun doing it. And the riding came easy, the racing didn't. The racing was something I liked to do, but I wasn't necessarily good at it right away.
Any other sports?
I was in track in high school, and myself and one other teammate made up the cross country team. So we both did the mile and the 2 mile, and that was it. And then I didn't really do anything, you know, structure-wise in college. It was just doing some mountain bike rides and races with some friends. And then my first cyclocross race was when I was just finishing up college. And a friend of mine had said, have you ever heard of this? It's called cyclocross. You can pick up your bike and you get to go over these barriers. And I said, can I do it on my mountain bike? And he's like, yeah. And we were like, okay. So we drove drove from La Crosse to Green Bay, Wisconsin and did our first cyclocross race.
What year is that?
That was 2002.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You and I basically
around
this. I think my first race was 2003.
Yeah. So
I was in a different spot. I was coming into it almost as a master.
Okay. Yeah, sure. But same time frame. Yeah. I mean, there were some good races in the Wisconsin scene. I did two races that year and both on my mountain bike. And I'll never forget it. It was fun. It was actually the first time my first race, I did win. And I was in the C class and I went on my mountain bike and I won a pair of Volley shorts, and that was my first mountain bike. That's my first mountain bike shorts.
That's amazing.
Like I think I was just wearing like actual baggies and no shorts up until then. And then I was like, oh well, I won some shorts. These will be kind of fun. This is what people ride in, you know. I think I might have had a jersey, but no shorts or something funny like that. And that was my first experience of getting into branching out and using my mountain bike for something else, which is a whole other experience.
Yeah, back in the day with the ABC categories.
Yep.
And then you got to be called a sandbagger after like your first race.
Yeah, exactly. Like bump right out. And I think I even did the state championships that year. I honestly think I remember going down and be like, well, let's see what the state championships are like. Of course, I got like butt handed to me, but it was cool to see.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So straight into cyclocross as really, other than the mountain biking, cyclocross really the first discipline that yeah. you were involved in. No road racing at that point, nothing
no,
like that.
No, and none of that came, I mean, some of the road racing I did came much later, but I had done some mountain biking, two cyclocross, maybe three cyclocross races total in Wisconsin before I moved to Seattle. And then racing actually took a second backseat pretty deep for what became my true love at the time, which was becoming a bike messenger.
What got you to Seattle? Because that's really where when I think of Craig Etheridge, that's what I think of, is like you as a Pacific Northwest guy.
Right, yeah. And a lot of my like developing career and cycling history has come from that area. But yeah, truly still from Wisconsin through and through. But my move to Seattle just came when I was finished with college, and a friend of mine said, let's go somewhere new. And I honestly had nothing holding me back, and I thought it was a great opportunity and nothing specific bringing me there except for this good friend of mine. And so we found a place. And at the time I thought, well, I guess I could try and be a bike messenger here. That would be one of those things that I'd wanted to tick off the list. And that really developed into like where I started to learn, not just, oh, I can go mountain biking with my buddies on these trails in Wisconsin, but I could actually ride, well, for work, for transportation for the first time as like a consistent and standard of my life, but then also ultimately becoming part of like my job and like who it really ended up defining me in a way.
Yeah, but coming out of college, just any other plans, or was like, I'm just going to go be a bike messenger?
At the time, it was that. It was, yeah. I said, well, I can, they said, oh, your marketing degree will appreciate over time. And until then you can maybe do something else. This is the best advice I could get. And I said, I'll take that advice and I'll let my marketing degree appreciate for a little while. And I will take you up on that. Maybe go try to be a bike messenger, angle. And that's exactly what I did in 2003.
Isn't that funny though, that the whole marketing piece did actually appreciate and came back and to came what back. You're doing now?
Yeah, it came back to me now. And I'm still, you know, in some ways that, you know, I never thought about it. And I thought about it while I was a bike messenger. I thought, I don't know if I'm really utilizing this career as much as I had been. But I think over time, you know, you do sort of pick and choose what you remember and what you learn from the, you know, from your past. And I also took advantage of that and did apply that later.
So moving into a really bike heavy scene, once you get to Seattle, one, what was the messenger scene like? You got into it, I don't know, it was kind of the beginning of the death throes for messenger life.
One of many.
Yeah, well, here, of course, you know, post 9/11, when there really wasn't any mail anymore in DC, that was sort of a tough time for the local crew here.
I think I remember seeing at least one, maybe two, during the time that I was a messenger, articles written about the death of the messenger. So obviously it depends on who you ask and it depends on the timing. But when I entered, of course it seemed great. Like to me, it was everything I thought it was going to be. It was as busy as we needed it to be. And we had a pretty vibrant scene. Like there was a community of messengers. There might've been 60 or 70 at the time, dwindling down, of course, over the time throughout the years. Now this is 2004 to 2014. Yeah.
Full decade. That's almost a lifer.
Yeah,
network.
It's a full decade. And also what you realize pretty quickly, and any messenger who listens to the podcast will recognize, it's a slippery slope at that point. Like I'm into it and I'm loving it and it doesn't get any better. But you also have to recognize, well, is it still what I want to do? And is this the time for me to get out, or maybe it's not? And that's the decision you get to make. But you get close to realizing, ooh, I could get myself into a position where I'm not going to do something else. And that's not bad, but it's also at that point in time what I realized I wasn't going to do.
Did you find yourself like in the alley cat scene? Was that part of it?
Oh, yeah.
Did you almost like cut your teeth racing in that scene?
I did. And that all came with part of the atmosphere. Like I had a supportive group of messenger friends. You know, it really is like a community. It's a family. And we all supported the idea of just having fun and doing these alley cats, getting out there and doing these rides together and being competitive too. And honestly, like in some ways it's funny because half the messenger scene might not necessarily care to push themselves in what would essentially be more work after work, But the other half kind of liked the idea of the challenge and the thrill of it. And so I definitely got caught up into that. And that was still what I would say continued to spark my interest in racing and ultimately transitioning out into other types of racing, not just that style.
And we saw that a lot. And we saw that, I mean, it was huge in the DC area. I think when I started Crosshair Cycling, it was half messengers at that point. And that really was the transition for a lot of these folks who had never done like a, I don't know if real's the right word, a sanctioned race.
A sanctioned race.
And, you know, there's so many stories, I think, like yours, where that was the entry and then it became a serious racing career from there.
Yeah, exactly. I have a very specific memory of an alley cat when the prize I won was my first ever set of cyclocross tires. And that literally transitioned into, oh, that's right. Years ago, I did this cyclocross race. I kind of forgot about it for a while. Like that mountain bike race, the cyclocross race in Wisconsin that I had done on my mountain bike. I guess I remember doing it, but it wasn't really on my radar. And it was in a new city and I already had something else going on and a new aspect of riding and a new outlook on where I was. And also, you know, it takes some resources to do cyclocross. And maybe I wasn't quite in the position where I was able to do that. And I literally won a pair of cyclocross tires and they were Schwalbes. And I threw them on my messenger bike at the time, which was a single speed. And I said, oh, I can just take this old Peugeot out and race it in cyclocross, I guess.
I was going to ask if you were, you know, track bike, single speed when you were messengering.
It was like a single speed, like city bike. But, you know, I mean, it was like a classic old Peugeot forward facing dropouts. You could just smash that wheel in there and bend the dropouts so it fit just right. And then eventually what I realized with these giant calipers would fit 35s. And that's exactly what I did for at least two seasons. And that would have been 2005, 2006, before I ever bought what would at the time be considered a more dedicated cross bike, even though that was still a caliper single speed commuter.
So when did it start, or when did you get it start racing seriously and kind of building up your racing resume?
I guess that was, I mean, realistically, that was probably, I mean, I guess there's two ways to look at this. One way is racing seriously might not have actually ever changed from just racing more, because I think what I always did was I just raced as much as I ever could and I was serious about it, but I didn't really ever take it that much more seriously. Like, I think,
did you ever train?
I never trained. I worked as a messenger and I had this amazing opportunity with the place I was working at and the guys I was working with, and they allowed me the time off and they said, hey, if you want to go race on the weekends, that's cool. We'll pick up some slack. Midweek day off if you need to go do some rides. But I didn't actually have any structure to it. It was just riding during the week, racing on the weekends.
So never any intervals, never any heart rate monitors.
No.
Power meters.
No, it was pretty.
And at some point you had a pro racing contract.
And at some point in time, I met the right people and I'll forever be indebted to Raleigh and Brian Fornes, because they said, you know, we could take this. This is our opportunity to like do something where you're doing a good job with the kind of racing you're doing. And it was simply just representing the single speed category. Like, it was just representing like a subculture that was getting more popular and a style of racing in a subset of people that they said, you know what, if you want to take this on the road with us, we'd be willing to support it.
At that time, and I don't know if I'm skipping anything between you racing and then getting that offer from Raleigh, were you also racing on a geared bike? Were you doing the USGP scene later on, or any type of, you know, cross crusade or races like that in the area?
So I had the other day when we
I'm had sorry just, for saying cross crusade when you were
no
Seattle
you can say
guy.
That because I will say I actually did a little bit of my own research on remembering when it was that I raced that season. I did a full season of the cross crusade once, okay, because I was, I don't know, just same thing, just looking to branch out. Like, I'd done Seattle cyclocross. I think this was pre-MFG at the time. I'm going to just go down and do a whole season of cross crusade. Obviously, like, they have a great scene, just as many fun racers. I had just as many friends down there. I felt as I did anywhere else, so I could, you know, just see my friends there for a while. But I did have a season or two of kind of biting my teeth into half and half. I would do some geared races, but I wasn't very good at it. So I probably just stuck with single speed because it was what I felt more comfortable doing. And then taking a minute to realize that that was the style that I liked the best. That was where I felt the most comfortable.
So most of these UCI elite races that you were jumping into still on the single speed.
Yeah. And that wasn't exclusive. I think at one point in time when I was racing on Raleigh, we had this idea where I think everybody on the team, including the mechanics and the manager, Don, would know I actually probably was better on the single speed, but I couldn't hang in the starts on the geared or without the geared bike. So I would start on a geared bike and get a lap in or two laps in and then switch to the single speed. And that became my preferred method. But I know for a fact, and I had done a little bit more looking and thinking about this, I know for a fact I'd never ever won a geared cyclocross race. Like I've entered a few.
Yeah.
And I've done okay. And I've entered a few geared cyclocross races on my single speed, but I've never actually won a cyclocross race on a geared bike. Which is sort of like a funny, like when I sat back and thought about it, I was like, I guess that is sort of true. Yeah.
So you never, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, I'm just curious, you never got like VO2 max testing and none of that kind of stuff?
No.
Because that's the kind of, when I look at you and I see you out there racing, that's one of the things is like, you have this huge engine and I'm sure it's just from built up from all the single speed riding, but at the same time, there's a genetic component to that. We always joke that you're the guy that we can always like have a conversation with when you're coming around in a race because right. you're still able to just sort of plug along with the leaders and talk their ear off at the same time.
Yeah, and I honestly wondered my whole racing career if because I was doing that is the thing that kept me from in a way taking it too seriously. That doesn't have anything to do with like how well I could actually race, but because I was just having fun all of the time and that was how I approached it, that it helped me to actually put things aside, like put away the fact that I was pushing it so far, pushing it so hard outside of the fact that I was just still having fun doing it. And maybe that was my angle.
Yeah, that's interesting. So just kind of like compartmentalizing the pain
exactly.
and the suffering
yes.
just and having this sort of outward,
yep.
we're just going to smile and have fun.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Any races where in that, because if people didn't witness, there's one I think it was like Nittany one year when they had that awful like mud bog through there.
Oh yeah.
And you're up there at the front and I forget who it was, but whoever the guy was, and it could sound almost like you are taunting them, but just knowing you, I think it was still like all honesty. She's like, "You are going so well in here. How do you push such a big gear through this mud?" And just like on this guy's ear and like with that any time ever where they're like, "Craig, just be quiet."
I definitely have recognized there's been times when it seems like a fun idea to be chatting with somebody right now, but that's also sometimes when people need it to be shut off. And I might not have known that, you know, there's a balance between being chatty and fun in a race, but then also being a little bit too annoying. And I know I've crossed the line, and I would appreciate if anybody in the future even said, "This isn't when we want to talk." But I also think sometimes it's like maybe a change of pace. Like, oh, well, I'm not trying to be aggressive with it. I think legitimately it when I see something that I like or see something that inspires me, I'll actually say it in the middle of a race.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's refreshing. And it's, as I said, it's always fun. And it's something that I know people enjoy when you're out there racing, just being a spectator for that. Raleigh, it was Raleigh Clement, right?
Raleigh Clement. And then also previously for that one year, actually just Raleigh.
Okay, that's why I kept like hesitating before saying it, because I wasn't sure when that change
so
came.
When that transition came, it was a little bit of a branch out from what the team I was riding for at the time, the Hodala squad in Seattle. And so that was Raleigh based. We had sponsorships kind of crossing over, and that was strictly just a social drinking club with a winning problem, which is our original slogan. And my opportunity came from that experience. Like, we had this team, I was willing and able, and at a place in my racing, you know, career basically, and then also in the opportunity that was given to me from Raleigh to actually go out on the road with them and promote some of the bikes and do some of the racing. And that was our very first year with Johnny Sant.
So who else is on the squad at that point? Because it was a pretty big squad eventually, wasn't it?
Eventually it was. So in the very beginning, it was myself and two other local racers, Russell Stevenson of the Seattle area at the time, and Jenny Gartner. And then the year beyond that is when it merged with Clement. That was Raleigh Clement. And at that time, it was Ben Bearden, Caroline, myself, and then ultimately Alan Krugoff, and then Jamie Driscoll, and Rebecca Gross was on the team for a year. And, I mean, this is like over the span of a couple years, 2012, 2013. Nicole Duke was also on the team. And this was like a little bit of ebb and flow through those years. This was 2011, 12, 13, and 14.
For his years in the U.S., Ben was always kind of a U.S. cyclocross folk hero. Any good Ben Bearden stories that stick out?
You know what's funny is that I'll say one Ben Bearden story that, and this isn't even a story, but it's just a likeness to the kind of person he was. The first person to text me on my birthday, Ben Bearden. If you're having trouble with your girlfriend or your wife, or you're not feeling down, first person to find out and reach out to you, Ben Bearden. Became one of just like the most considerate and thoughtful people that I have known in bike and outside of bike relationships. Just a really heartfelt, sincere guy that, I mean, the story that I remember is just him being like really compassionate about what he was doing and all about the people he was surrounded with. And that was something that I'll always remember. And that was something that we thought of years after we stopped racing together.
How many times do you think he could bench press you right now?
Oh, like a million. There's photos of us like together where he's clearly just completely ripped. And I'm just like somehow scrawny and managing to like not nearly hang on to him, but be in the same vicinity, which is pretty cool. And and by now, of course, he is a monster.
That transformation is just insane.
Yeah, he's a fantastic guy, and really just like one of the most sincere guys out there.
That's good. I do. You had the opportunity. You went out to Nationals this year. Got to hook back up with your Hogala crew.
I had to take advantage of that because, well, first of all, racing back or and just being back in the Lakewood, the Tacoma area, like that course, that Stella Kuhn course, I'd done a number of different USGPs there. Some of my best races ever were on that course. And I had to take the advantage of just going back out there and seeing what the scene is like and also seeing it on, you know, our nation's biggest stage. It was amazing. And also to see the kind of work that Zach and Terry and the crew had put together with like taking a landscape that's been used so many times and altering it one more time to be something completely different. It was amazing to see. And it was also pretty cool to see the support from not only, you know, the local scene, but then of course, like the rest of the country coming together and like on that stage with, I thought it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. And that the Hodala crew there definitely made it a unique and great experience.
Always looking to elevate the experience. Yeah. And for them to recognize and for the management to recognize, like, let's give these guys a little bit of a leeway. It's going to be fun. They're actually pretty responsible, surprisingly enough. Let's let them kind of go and people are going to love it. And sure enough, that's exactly the kind of thing that, the rest of the country can recognize. Like, they're having fun.
If people haven't listened to my conversation with Zach and Terry, where the rumors that preceded Hodala to reality were a little different.
They are. And I think Zach and Terry are probably the first people to recognize, you know what? These guys are actually okay. I mean, they knew it all the whole time, but it's also kind of fun to like put that faith in the crew and then also to be a part of that family. Like that is one of my first cyclocross memories is being a part of that crew and how much fun we had, but also how hard we rode. You know, we had this great experience. We had a great scene and we pushed each other and we had a really good run at it.
Back in, it had to be like 2012 around there. So I guess I'm guessing the Raleigh
Clement days.
Days. before we all knew the word vlog, you kind of were like on the forefront, and you laugh, but Hot Laps Craig, I loved it. I thought it was such a great thing. How did that come about? How did you think? I'm not even sure YouTube was started at that point or was even around.
I'll actually give credit in two places. Part of the idea was from Johnny Sun.
That makes sense.
We had a lot of time in the van traveling to races. This was a lot of this was pre-flying to races. So we drove around in the van to Cincy 3 and Louisville and all these big races together. And by more than one standard, given me a number of different pointers. We'll say if I was ever had been coached by somebody more than another person, I'll give him credit there. Mostly in the phrase of, Kregels, you don't know how to steer your bike. Let me tell you what to do. And he would give me some tips as we would ride around the course. And then also he had opened my eyes to the term hot route or hot laps. And that is literally where the beginning of the idea for the laps came from. Is he and I riding around the course saying, you need to talk about these laps. You need to do something. We need to like put something together. And then ultimately, Alan Krugoff really came to my...
Gotta have the camera guy.
You gotta have a camera guy and you gotta have an ideas guy. And we kind of fed ideas off of each other, and he knew how to get the shot, and he also knew how to edit. And as much as it was not edited, it kind of had to be a little bit edited. And Alan was an editor and still is very good at it. But he also knew exactly how to make it look not edited, but sort of edited. And he was instrumental in getting that off the ground, because the opportunity was there. Once again, I was on this national circuit. I was traveling around with all these really fun people. I was also there to race, but I also had a little bit of downtime so we could have some fun with it. And then also the opportunity to find out all the people that were at the top, top, top of our sport were really just as approachable as anybody else. And maybe somebody needs to recognize that in a fun, like 10-minute video. And sure enough, they were, and they are. And that was my opportunity to like showcase that, even on like a small YouTube scale, basically.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's, I think I've talked about that a lot, and it's why I've been able to kind of do what I do in this sport is because of that. It's not closed off. It's something where everybody really is accessible. And even to the point that, you know, when you get like these bigger name European racers and they come to the US and they're not mauled by thousands of people, they're the same way too.
Sure.
And they're happy when they're not like crowded by everyone to just kind of chat. So you and Powers doing stuff around
the same
time?
They were kind of around the same time. And obviously on different levels, but I mean... Always keeping it grassroots. So we had a lot of the same opportunities and we're in the same places, but mine was just very much filmed on my...
Are they still out there?
Oh, I think so. Well, yeah. They might be. They might have been locked away into Vimeo at some point. I should probably bring them back up.
Yes. I have an outlet if you need to put them somewhere.
Okay. The re-release is what we need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about the most recent nationals. I know it's not your favorite subject or a subject you really want to talk about at all, but I do want to talk about just single speed's place in national championships.
Sure.
If that's okay.
We can talk about it. I mean, we should talk about it. It has to be talked. I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
It's in nationals. And
if people don't know, the only reason I'm dancing around this is that, you know, you ran into some hot water. I'm going to say most likely not deserved, but it's kind of like how the early, was it even Twitter at that point?
Like basically right on the edge of Twitter, and basically was on the edge there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was certainly something that was out there.
Yeah. And yeah, so you went into national USA Cycling National Championships. Had you won single speed national championships?
No, okay. Definitely not. No.
Okay.
I had never won. I've gotten sort of 7th or 12th.
Okay.
But yeah. I had not won, and I wasn't necessarily planning on winning. It wasn't my right to win, and I definitely had a hot take afterwards, And I definitely had a lot of feelings about it. And I think it was just because, I think not just because, but I know it was because I cared a lot about it. And I really just didn't recognize where other people were coming from at the time, I think. And yeah. I think that was part of what got me so riled up at the end, or...
Yeah, well, let me set it up. I don't know. So, because I think you had some legitimate points in here, and it's something that USA Cycling had been struggling with for a while. And what it really came down to was elite racers, mostly men's elite racers, who were looking for an edge for their race on Sunday. Yeah. For the championship race.
So a lot of times before that time, the race was Friday.
Yeah. Okay.
Or Thursday.
So, right. So whenever the national championship race was, and if you've never been to Nats before, it's not like your local race. It's not even like any normal UCI weekend where you can show up Friday, session the course for an hour or two, do the same thing like Saturday morning.
And expect everything to be exactly the same Sunday.
Yeah.
Possibly.
And do your race, and it's not a problem. I mean, right. You have all the intel you need. When you come to Nationals, it's actually even gotten a little better, but it's still crazy in that the windows of opportunity to see the track before your race are very small.
They're limited.
And
there's a lot of categories now.
Yeah. And then on top of that, the ability to see the course without 1,000 other people on it.
Right.
So you actually can see how a line works without, you know, and more power to them, but without like juniors and Cat Fives on there and everyone else.
Right. Any doing kind of the race same, base, right.
Doing the same for their race that you don't get to do that. And so the hack for that was, at one point it was racing masters races.
Right.
And then I believe they stopped that. They said if you can't race age category and
I think that's
elite.
Right.
So that was stopped. So then the loophole became the single speed race.
Exactly.
In that you could basically pay for trademark Craig Etheridge, hot laps,
hot rents
to go and get into that single speed race, dial in some lines, really see what's going on. And I don't think you were alone. There is, as we know, you can joke about it and say it's an equipment choice, not a category, all this
right,
kind of stuff.
Right.
Other people are like, it's a lifestyle. This is what I do. This right. is a completely different discipline. But then you had all of these other people in that category who were like amazing racers.
Right, right. And no doubt, amazing racers.
Yeah. And it just, it took... And they had every right to be there, but it changed the environment and kind of the vibe of the race.
I think,
and that's what I get. Really was what you had issue.
And I
with.
Think sometimes I even then and sometimes now even had a hard time articulating what it was that made me, that what it was that I felt about it. And I think it just because it at the time it meant. Felt like it meant so much to me, and it meant different things to different people, and it meant less. And I guess I couldn't at the time say that it meant less to some people, but the circumstances were not, they should have, I don't know. It's difficult to articulate, I think. And I think that does touch on a lot of where I was trying to go with it.
Yeah. And I think your struggle to do that and what happened was that you tried to do that and you did
right.
it in this letter or this article that showed up in Cyclocross magazine.
Right.
And then that's when it all just kind
that's
of
when,
came out.
Yeah. It either came out that, and then part of the quote, I think, was also a little bit, that was a little bit presumptuous on my side. That was when I should have realized, okay, well, obviously I didn't want the experience for anybody else to be justified by what I thought was the best thing for everybody. But I did want it to mean something. I did want it to mean the same thing to the people who kind of had built up and worked for it all year. And it just at the time didn't seem like that was the case.
Right. If that is your goal.
If that is your goal.
Single speed is my goal at this national championship.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what I saw from this, and especially knowing you better since you've moved to the Mid-Atlantic, and that I don't think people understand, is that you and Julia are like the biggest fans and supporters of everything cycling that goes on in the region. I mean, if there's an event, you're going to be there. If there's a fundraiser, you guys are supporting it. Yeah. If there's like merch that somebody's putting out, you guys are buying it, and it's that kind of energy that is just like, it honestly, it just like warms my heart to see that.
Thank
from
you.
People, because it's great, and it's what our community was built on. And then you're sort of coming in here and giving it that extra jolt, which has been really cool.
Thank you. You know, I will say, like, in the end, I definitely would never have wanted to like alienate anyone from the experience that they were going to have. And I think that's something that I've been able to just holistically more like follow through with, especially since leaving that aspect of my life behind, like that professional career, that racing full time, like nationally, and then just focusing on the place that I live in. And like, it's funny because somebody said, you know, friends of mine in Seattle have asked as soon as I moved, like, well, what are you racing? Like, are you going to still keep going? And realistically, on paper, I think I'm actually for a few years had done more races just locally and understood that that's still what I wanted to do and still what I wanted to support. This is the scene here.
Yeah, I don't think people understand, although I tell them all the time, I don't think people who live here understand how spoiled they are, especially
right.
with cyclocross.
Yeah.
That we can race Saturday and Sunday and you're really not traveling more than an hour usually.
Right. Yeah, it's a fantastic opportunity. And in that regard, I got really lucky with where my wife needed to move for work, because she could have moved into a lot of regions where we don't have quite the support that we've got in this area.
Yeah, and you jumped right into that whole Charm City crew.
Exactly.
And have been part of that race organization.
Yeah, one of the first people I met when I moved to Baltimore was Chris Auer, and at the time was running and had owned and started 2020 Cycling, but not to mention Charm City and the race, so that was a really easy transition for us to join the team and become a part of building our new community on the East Coast together in conjunction with everything you guys do here and then the rest of Mabra.
Yeah. And then it's always great to have you showing up for those garage races as well.
The garage races. That's, you know, I'll say as soon as the garage races hit my radar, I realized this is the perfect complement to my racing career. I mean, it's part alley cat. It's literally underground. It's a little bit renegade, kind of roadie, but kind of not the roadies you'd see out on the regular weekend. Like, you kind of got to have a little bit of edge to you in order to appreciate the fact that you're in an alley cat in a parking garage.
There are only a handful of local Cat 2 or Cat 1 roadies who will show up to that because they're under the impression that somehow that's more dangerous than racing in a pack at
right.
32 miles per
right.
hour on asphalt.
Right. And then what they realize quickly is that actually they could be pretty darn good at it. And the last couple of people that I've raced against have been very good at it. But you have to still have that little bit of edge, even if, like, realistically, it's about as safe as it can be.
Yeah, it's... For most people out there, you know, they're going to crash. And yeah. the thing is, what they're all worried about is crashing into a pillar, where really it's just taking turns too tight.
Yep.
And you're
gonna
your
slide
going
slide
out.
Yeah. Right.
But it's, yeah, not to sing that event's praises too much, but sliding on that floor feels much better than sliding on asphalt.
Any asphalt or even a gravel corner,
yeah.
Right?
So, Since being out here, sort of transitioning your career, working for Noon, is that am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Noon?
Just like
okay.
the time of day.
Like the time of day.
It's getting confusing nowadays because there's a lot of advertisements on NPR for Noom.
Noom, right.
And so I get a lot of people who say, I love that app. And I'm like,
yeah.
Well, we make hydration opportunities, not an app. And by hydration opportunities, I mean products, but yeah, Noon, like the time of day, N-U-U-N.
And that's just to put the bookend on it. That's what we're talking about when the marketing finally came
exactly
came back in there. And
yeah,
it's kind of cool. I mean, you sort of get to still do, I'm assuming, whatever you want to do bike wise yet
exactly
have this solid job that's actually lasted throughout this time, which is
certainly has
been, you know, we've seen a lot of people not in that same situation.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. And honestly, I've been lucky since the beginning of my even search to move to Baltimore to be with my now wife. And the opportunity came up at noon for them to need a sales rep in the area. And I've been able to work with them and the company over here. And it's been a really good opportunity and a great run with the company. We've grown, we've expanded, and now I've changed roles a couple times and still been able to stay connected and have the diversity I want and need to race and ride as much as I want while still supporting, you know, like a great product and a great company to work for.
Do you have any, once assuming we are all free to go do what we want, when and where we want to do it, any plans bike wise? I mean, any like long term, ooh, I want to go do event X in gravel or anything like that out there on the horizon? Or
I kind of go back and forth with that. And I've actually gone back and forth with that even in the cyclocross racing I've done in the last few years. We've had a lot of great, I mean, even just together now in these past few years in the Mid-Atlantic area, we've had some really fantastic seasons, like full of all the races we've ever wanted to do. And every season I think, I'm going to tick something new off the list. Maybe just travel somewhere else, or maybe just cut it down to like the few that I want to do and really focus on. Ultimately, well, in the last few years, at least, that necessarily hasn't happened. I've still kind of kept it pretty high level with like the number of races that I'm doing. This year, we've actually just started to take a real long look at where can we go for like a solid week and just explore by ourselves, because, well, obviously, even currently, that's something we can do. And also, we're not really going to rely on the fact that infrastructure might not be there for events. I mean, we're already seeing that right now. So we might as well take advantage of the time that we have to ourselves and transition away to just doing the rides that we would have done, or maybe the big events or races. One of the things I had signed up for earlier in the year was the Belgian Waffle Ride. And of course, it's been delayed. It might be delayed again. I might still try to do something like that, or maybe just think about doing something like that on my own. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of people start to appreciate and support.
It is interesting getting away from that competition aspect of it, and we see it a lot. But then also, I don't know, I think these things sort of go in waves. I don't think that the competition can disappear. I think people are going to want it. I just don't know what it looks like. You were somebody who raced cyclocross, had a pro contract, but you didn't fall into the same kind of pursuit that I think a lot of people I talk to do, where it's like, okay, well, I need to map out my calendar. I need to get these points at all these races so that I can be gridded up here at these World Cups and then maybe make the World Championship team and then spend some time in Europe.
Thankfully, some of that was never part of my plan.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that's right. Not really where you ever
right.
approach things, yet you still race. You still seem to have fun racing it. So do you ever look at where we're at with cyclocross? I mean, you and I, as we said, both came into this at the same time. We saw, I think, from when you did that first race on your mountain bike race, which I'm assuming was not a very big field,
right,
to, you know, 2010 era, where we're looking at massive fields and the sport is just going to go back gangbusters for however long, to where we're at now, which I think is kind of a plateau. You know, mm-hmm. We've definitely lost people to gravel, lost things to other places. What do you think? I mean, is there something that needs to change in cyclocross, or is it just like, look, as I said, it's ebb and flow and people will be back?
I honestly think that's it. I think it'll come. I think it's been up and down. We've seen the numbers rise. We've seen the USGB come and go. We've seen Worlds here. We'll see Worlds here again. And we'll see the interest in that American cyclocross has, with still and probably continuing to be primarily racer-based participation. I mean, racer-based, not participation, but
organization.
Yeah. And it might come down a little bit. And obviously, after a year like this, when we have to take a step aside, we're going to have to revisit some of our approach to how big we want these series to be or how big the sponsorship dollars can support. But I think the core audience will still be there. I think people are going to want to race when it's appropriate and when it's something that we can safely do.
At the top level, do you think we'll ever get to a place in the U.S.? And I think this season is a huge marker in this, just like just what we're seeing now with cyclocross racers who, unless they have plans to go to Canada for a month and then go to Europe, which they better be doing now, or it's kind of like they're not going to get there. And then even if in Europe, racing will continue, and what the access will be for U.S. racers, is this the point where we start looking at maybe doing our own thing in the country at the top level? I mean, as a, you know, as a racer, but I know you're also just a fan of that racing and following it. Do you think that's a possibility where we could get to where it is more just a sort of homegrown American scene for our top racers?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that would be nice to see. I think it would be something we could do because like the how obtainable it is for enough people or anyone to get to Europe it seems like it's getting harder to do. It seems like it's getting further away and we're getting further away as not as an organization specifically, but as like individuals to get out and make something like that happen, especially with where we are in that flow of sponsorship dollars and how big race teams and how much money and how many resources it takes to get over there. Like we'll certainly always benefit from the amount of experience that people can gather from racing overseas, but having enough people at the higher end focus on like a more consistent national series or a national races that they can gather and learn from each other here, in a way, would almost be more beneficial, I would think.
Yeah, and I think that's always the question is how to compel people to want to do that. You know, and I even look at, you know, Charm City and Chris and, you know, even with DCCX, I mean, where UCI races, one is like you work hard to get to that point. You don't want to give it up. But right. The other thing, I mean, I know with Chris, part of his thing is he wants to give the opportunity for the best racers to have somewhere to do a world-class race, including, you know, those up-and-coming ones, and it's to support that. And I just like, and I think that's the kind of the pool that we have of like, well, is that the right thing? Is that the best way to sort of develop talent and give like top racers the best opportunity? Or is it to say, okay, we're maybe not UCI, but maybe we find a way to offer more prize money or do something else. And I think that's the struggle that we're in now.
That is the struggle. And we're going to have to kind of keep fighting through that. For the time being, it still seems like the best approach. It still seems like creating enough draw in a region at a specific time frame is about as good as we can do. But ideally, getting that to extrapolate into like a little bit bigger like national scene or national series, that is.
Yeah.
Easier said than done.
I know.
Has been done. Wasn't easy.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see if it comes back. I know it's I didn't even want to get into it, but everybody always thinks it's the return of the USGP, and I don't know if that's.
But we already said that.
That's not the answer.
Not necessarily the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Craig, thanks for coming down and chatting.
You bet, Bill. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Thanks.
Searching for the stories outside of cycling, but still inside cycling?
The Gravelot is a weekly interview series where we talk about our shared experiences in the cycling community and talk with people that we think you guys might be interested in.
Absolutely. And the Gravelot is actually not always about gravel, but it is the place that is your local trailhead.
It could be the meetup parking lot where you meet your friends.
Or the post-ride watering hole.
It's really the place where you sit down, share your stories, and talk about life.
Yeah, and dive into the things that really matter to you on two wheels or beyond.
The Gravelot has brand new episodes every single Thursday morning, along with a bi-weekly editorial column every other Tuesday.
So check out the show, check out the Beeline, and join the conversation and find out all you need to know about the Gravelot at thegravelot.com.